Okay, we are in Mark chapter 5, specifically verse 18. We're going to try to get all the way through chapter 5 today. We've just been talking about Jesus' interaction, specifically with the demoniac in the region of the Gerasenes. What happened in this event? It was just yesterday. I know it's 7, but... what happened? Say it again. Yeah. Basically, just to sum it all up, the interaction with Jesus with the demon that identifies himself as Legion, it ends by them begging him not to send him out of the region, probably because this region was highly non-light. I don't know. I guess I could have just said darkness. But as a result, Jesus sent him into the pigs, kills all the pigs, and then what happens? Yeah, the people come in verse 17 and they say, get out of here. What are the possibilities of why they're asking him to get out of here? Yeah, primarily, probably, because maybe he's trying to start a rebellion. Because we talked about the 10th for Tensus yesterday, the Roman legion that was ruling in the area primarily of Syria, but it would have stretched down to this region as well. And their Roman standard, even on their coins, was the symbol of a pig, which I said also goes back to the Remus and Romulus origin myth of Rome, where the founders of Rome were swine herdsmen. So it was a designation of honor that the legion had of the pigs. And because they were in this region, and because we have the name legion accompanied with the number around 2,000, there are some imperial elements that seem to be surfacing that could possibly explain why they are wanting Jesus to get out of the region. They're saying, hey, this could be misunderstood. We're already on the fringes of the empire. We don't want anything getting Rome's attention too much, as if we are rebelling against the ones that have given us everything that we benefit from. So they look at him and say, get out of here. We just can't handle this. Is it possible that there's other reasons? Yes, it could be just economic reasons. They're mad at him because he just destroyed their economy. That could be another possibility. It also could be just straight fear. Man, we don't know what to do with this. Instead of dealing with it, just get out of here. It's possible. Nevertheless, I do think that the imperial elements seem to explain the reaction a little more completely. Verse 18. As Jesus was getting into the boat, what does that tell us?
Back to the Sea of
Galilee. Yeah, he's going to the Sea of Galilee. What else?
He
agrees with them. Remember, I've told you the spiritual world is permission based. Whether we're talking demonic or we're talking Holy Spirit, it's permission-based. And if you say, you don't have a right here, I don't want you here, it will leave, whatever that it is. And they look at Jesus and they say, get out of here. And he doesn't say, no, I don't have to get out of here. I can stay here. I'm the Son of God. I can do what I want. He says, this is all permission-based. You invite me into your life, and I'll stay. You tell me to leave, and I'll go. I'm not going to fight you. I'm going to pursue you. But I'm not going to fight you. I'm not going to force my way into anything. As Jesus was getting into the boat, the man who had been demon-possessed begged to go with him. Now, here comes a deep irony. He begs to go with Jesus. And then verse 19, but Jesus didn't let him come. He said, no, you can't follow me. Why? Why would Jesus say something like that? Just not enough room in the boat. Sorry. Seats taken, you know.
Should it be that he wasn't Jewish?
Maybe it was. I mean, the fact of the matter is, where are we? We're in the Decapolis. He may not have been Jewish, and we do know that at this point, Jesus' method of ministry is to Israel first and then extending to the Gentiles. As a matter of fact, we do see Jesus interacting with Gentiles throughout his ministry. But he makes it very clear that's not the primary purpose of why he is here. But he also makes it very clear that his followers are to extend it beyond what he has taken it. So there is a possibility where he's saying, no, sorry, this starts first with the promises of God. That's possible. What other reasons?
Maybe he knew what was best for the guy, like after being possessed away from his family. Like maybe Jews, best that he went back and took care of his family and stuff like that.
Yeah, maybe so. Maybe Jesus has other people in mind. Absolutely. No, that's a good possibility. Yeah.
Just like a testimonial, because they wanted Jesus to leave, you know, for political reasons or whatever reason, but the guy was still there so he could spread what Jesus had done through a miracle.
Yeah, maybe it's evangelistic reasons. I mean, and here's just a missiological principle that you should take wherever you go, especially if you're in missions. But even also if you go into inner city, sometimes the inner city can seem just as foreign as a land as Africa. The people that are native to that place will always be the most effective. It's just the way it is. If you think that you can walk into in any given context and be the ones that you're going to bullhead away and just champion the gospel in every place, 9 times out of 10, native people in the land will be the most effective. 9 times out of 10. Are there situations in which the fact that your skin is white does give you more respect than other people? That is true. In some locations and in some places, that is true. But don't assume that's the way it is in every location. As a matter of fact, most of the time, that's not true. Yes?
What do you think about the fact that before Jesus told everybody not to talk about it, and they did, and now he's telling this guy to go and tell everyone?
There is almost an interesting reverse messianic secret here. Because you do have a sense of rejection in the sense that he says, no, you can't follow me. Why not? It's not for you to know. You just need to go back. And what does he do? He commands them, tell everyone. Tell everyone. And he does. And how do they respond at the end of verse 20? He tells everyone, and all the people were amazed. We're actually going to see this guy's fruit in a couple of chapters later once we come back to the same region. This guy will pop back up again. Well, his fruit will. He won't. But his fruit will. But there is an interesting, this is the only time right in the middle where he goes and says, go tell someone. And who is it to? Someone that is an outsider of all outsiders. That's interesting. May have something to do with the purpose of the messianic secret as a whole. But we'll get to that on the last day of class. Jesus did not let him come, but he said, go home to your family and tell them how much the Lord has done for you. Notice the identifying qualifier he puts there. Don't go tell him what the miracle worker did. Don't go tell him what the Savior did. Go tell him what the Lord has done. Your King, the one you've submitted to. And how he has had mercy on you. So the man went away and began to tell in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him. And all the people were amazed. We'll come back to that guy maybe in a couple weeks. Let's move on though for now. Verse 21, when Jesus had again crossed over by boat to the other side of the lake, there it is again, a large crowd gathered around him while he was by the lake. Then one of the synagogue rulers named Jairus came there, seeing Jesus, he fell at his feet. Stop right there. This is huge. Every single detail that you find Mark putting into the limited scroll that he has should not be overlooked, but should add to the whole picture of what's happening. Based on this first two verses, what strikes you? He's a synagogue ruler, which means what? What's that? He's Pharisaic, more than likely, because that's the stomping grounds of the Pharisees, is the synagogues. What else? Yeah. What's the recent track record of all the other Pharisees with Jesus? Yeah, last time we really even, you know, ran headlong into them was at the Beelzebub controversy. Huh? You're possessed by the prince of demons. And then Jairus comes. But notice the first detail that we see in this account. The first detail. He doesn't come to Jesus in secret. He doesn't pull him aside and say, hey, I've got a favor I'd like for you. What does he do? There's a great crowd that's surrounding Jesus. And Jairus comes right into the middle of it. The synagogue ruler. And he falls down on his knees and starts to beg Jesus in desperation to help him. What would that say about honor and shame in that situation? Why not? It didn't matter. Why not? What's that?
It's urgent.
Well, yeah, exactly. Because this is the reality. everything you hold valuable means nothing when you're put in a situation of desperation or suffering. I was talking to I'm sure you won't care if I tell you guys, I was talking to Michael Berry, who experienced crazy stuff in the tornado. Him and his roommate Kevin were in the bathtub, and he like when the tornado was coming, and he said all of a sudden he heard this loud bang. It almost felt like something pushed them out of the bathtub, and they fell basically into the bathroom floor. And then as soon as they did, the wall crashed in on the bathtub. And he's like, "What threw us out of the bathtub? We don't know." But both of them were thrown out and immediately was crushed. And so he said immediately, you know, they tried to, whenever they got out, they realized that the only thing that was really left was their bathroom where they were laying on the floor. So he said they got up and they basically pushed down the door as a way to walk over all the junk that was around them. And he said they were looking for shoes and they were doing the best they could to find shoes. And he said he goes over to this apartment complex that hadn't been hit too bad, and he started asking them, you know, and they gave him jackets because it was, you know, cold and rainy, and some shoes. But he started describing the rest of the night, and then he said this to me. Out of all this stuff, I'm just going, man, I'm sorry. He goes, you know what, though? Whenever I realized I had lost everything, he said, I've never felt more free in my entire life. And he said, he goes, and I understand that we need resources, you know, like cars to drive to ministries and, you know, and just different types of resources to accomplish bigger things for the gospel. He said, but man, every time I've been buying an extra thing to replace something I've lost, he said, I feel a part of me that I'm losing some of that freedom. And I thought that was a really keen insight. Because he even said, he goes, in that moment I realized how much I really had been materialistic. I didn't realize I was. But when you're in a moment of suffering and desperation, everything that you held valuable, all of a sudden isn't that valuable anymore. And in an honor-shame situation, where what Jairus has going for him is his sociological power, his sociological honor of being the synagogue ruler. If we are in Capernaum, we don't know exactly where we are because it doesn't tell us where they went. But if we are in Capernaum, this may have even been the synagogue ruler, the leader, over the synagogue of Peter, Andrew, James, and John. This is a guy that knows what is happening. If it's in Capernaum, he knows what Jesus has been doing. He even knows the clash. He gets what is at stake here. But the bottom line is, in a moment of desperation and suffering, all the things he holds valuable doesn't matter. He will cast away all of his honor, maybe even getting kicked out of the synagogue, even though he was the ruler, in order to come to Jesus and ask him. Because what is it that's driving him? His dying daughter. In ministry, huge principle, in ministry, even the people that are the most hardened against God, in times of suffering, sometimes will throw away all their intellectual objections. Throw it away and say, can you really help me? For example, 9/11. I don't know if there has been a Sunday in the last 100 years in which church attendance was so high than the Sunday after 9/11. I had people coming. I mean, I was a freshman in college here. I didn't really know exactly what I was doing and why I was doing it. I had people coming out of the woodwork contacting me saying, do you have any answers? What do we do in a time like this? And that's the moment when the church needs to arise. That's the moment where the church says, "This." There is something true. We were studying yesterday in Christology about the way in which Moltmann approaches, Jürgen Moltmann, how he approaches Jesus. And he says the conduit through which we can even start talking about Jesus and interacting with this incredible person of God is through suffering. That's our entry point. Because it's in the moment of suffering that we really understand Jesus and Jesus understands us. And there's a lot of truth in that. And a lot of times when you've never really gone through suffering, it's easy to dismiss something as contrived as that statement. And yet whenever suffering's a part of life, you start to say, no, I get it. I've said this in my Acts class more than once, and I'll say it in here. There is something about people that go through suffering that they understand Jesus way more than I ever will. Until the Lord counts me worthy of having me fellowship in the sufferings of Jesus. They just get it. It doesn't matter how many books I've read or how many lectures I teach. People that understand suffering in an intimate way just get depths of God I'll never touch. There's just something about it that opens people up to a new realm that I simply can't see. It's the same concept with rich and poor, by the way. There's something about the depths of God that in faith that the poor get that because of my position of wealth, I will never get. And even though I'm able to use my wealth to help the poor, there's still something they get that I don't. And that's what's happening here. Sometimes suffering isn't something just to lament or that disproves God. Sometimes suffering, I agree with C.S. Lewis, that pain sometimes is God's megaphone. Screaming out to someone that's hardened, and maybe sometimes that should even change some of our prayers for the way in which we pray for the spiritual growth of people. I do find it quite interesting that the Christians in China who experience suffering more than anybody do not pray that the persecution is alleviated. If you read the book Back to Jerusalem about the Church of China, they say, pray that we have stronger backs to endure. I was traveling with Vivert Lal in Russia, and he was lecturing on suffering and persecution while I was lecturing on Revelation. And at the end of every time, he'd ask, people would ask him, hey, what can we pray for you about? And I sat through like five of his lectures in two different cities. And finally, at the end, towards the end of our time, I just said, hey, I noticed every time people ask you that question, the one thing that you never say is to have the persecution stop. And I said, why don't you want me to pray for that? Or why don't you suggest that? He said, because it doesn't really matter if it stops. What we really need is boldness. The Chinese church calls prisons the universities. Because they said that's where you learn the most. Suffering does something to people that opens them up to the mysteries of God that if we did experience a dose of it, maybe our churches would have a harder time stagnating. I always think this whenever I'm going into churches with, you know, that are splitting over stupid stuff like carpet colors or worship music styles. And I always ask that, well, at least always goes in my mind. I don't know if I always say it out loud, but I always say, I wonder if the churches in China are arguing about the same things. I wonder if they split in the underground church of China because we don't like the way that guy plays the music. I doubt it. Because sometimes one of the things that suffering can actually offer you is perspective. It can reveal how selfish we really are. That styles of music is how we're going to gauge what church we go to. That's foolish. Then one of the synagogue rulers named Jairus, leaving all honor aside, came there to Jesus, fell at his feet, and pleaded earnestly with him. My little daughter, notice the emphasis. My little daughter, my baby girl, is dying. Please come and put your hands on her so that she will be healed and live. What is that? What is he enacting? You never see the word here in these first several verses, but what is he enacting? What? Belief, faith, right? Faith, by definition, is the acknowledgement and the submission to the identity and the power of Jesus. I don't know what else it looks like than what he's doing. He's saying, I know who you are and I know what you can do, and please do it. And so, verse 24, Jesus says, Jesus went with him. He said, yeah, your faith's right where it needs to be. A large crowd followed and pressed around him. And a woman was there who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years. The very description of the woman screams out, ostracized. As a matter of fact, I would say that there is, I don't know if there's anything else I could add, well, maybe Gentile, that would make this woman more completely ostracized. But let's just break it down. Number one, she is a woman. And in the ancient world, by default, she is a liability when it comes to honor. Women in the ancient world, honor is a limited commodity. It is a limited good. It's a limited resource. There's only so much to go around. And women don't contribute honor to a family situation. They merely protect the honor by not being shameful. They don't add anything to the resources of the family, both physically and honorifically. And this is just history. I'm sorry, ladies. But that's the way they were treated. They were considered parasites because the only thing they could do is take honor away from the family, not add anything to it. The only saving grace for a woman when it came to honor is her ability to bear children. Therefore, if she was barren, basically they would look at her as absolutely useless. And even her bearing of children, she was not even considered a full part of the family or the community until she bore a male child. Because that's whenever real honor is starting to be perpetuated inside the community. So the very fact that says she's a woman, there's one strike against her. The second thing is it says she's been bleeding. Bleeding, but basically what the word means is a perpetual menstruation cycle for 12 years. And if you know anything about Jewish cultic rituals of clean and unclean, whenever the woman is in her time of menstruation, she is considered unclean and would have to go through ritual purity rituals to purify herself after the menstruation cycle is over. And this woman has been perpetually in a menstruation cycle for 12 years, which means she has been ritually, cultically unclean for 12 years. I also think the number 12 rounds out this picture. What is the number 12 pointing to? We've already talked about this.
She's a wholly unclean, like just as unclean as you can get.
Mm-hmm. The number 12 points to completion, to totality. Now, is it possible that the number 12 is just the historical fact? It's been 12 years. It's possible. I'm not even saying that's not even improbable. However, at the very end of this scene, we will see that the little daughter is specifically named as being the age of 12, and that's not an accident. I believe there's something literally going on here too, where he's connecting the two girls, even though we have an interruption of one miracle with another one. And the question we'll ask in a minute is why? Why is he interrupting a miracle to start another miracle? There's several possibilities in that. I'll get there in just a second. Go ahead.
Does it also have something to do with Israel and the 12 tribes?
Absolutely. I believe that this whole entire scene is describing the spiritual plight of Israel. I'm going to start answering the question that I didn't answer in order to ask your question, which actually filtered right into what I didn't answer. Anyway, where was I going? I believe that what's happening here is this. You have interesting contrast with the people that come to Jesus that are asking for the same thing. You have an interesting contrast. Both of them are subjecting themselves to sociological ridicule by coming into the midst of the crowd. Jairus was, because of his honor. So is this woman, because if she is around other people or touching them, she can make them unclean as well, because of her ritual impurity. They're both sacrificing something huge. Both of them are in absolute desperation. Differences, though, however, is economically, these two people would be on the extremes of the spectrum. Jairus economically would have been well taken care of, probably as a synagogue ruler. He would have been more than likely, I guess I should say. She definitely would not have been. Ostracized from the community, probably would have to be forced to be either begging. Probably begging is where you'd land on that. When it comes to honor, they couldn't be any more diametrically opposed, could they? He is the synagogue ruler, the Jewish elite, the ruler of the entire city, synagogue, an important city that is Capernaum. And she is completely ostracized from all the community. And yet, how does Jesus respond to both of them? What? How does he respond to both of them? We'll get there eventually, but go. You know the end of the story. How does he respond to both of them? He heals both of them because of their faith. The message is this. Israel, I get you're a mess. From one end of the spectrum to the other, you're a mess. And yet, if you come to me in faith, I'll heal all of you. You see, the message of the gospel does have a lot to do with the poor, but it doesn't mean that it has nothing to do with the social elite. Ultimately, though, the social elite have to do something that's very similar to the poor in order to come to Jesus in faith. And that is complete submission. To desperately rely on what Jesus can offer you that you yourself can't provide. And we both find the meeting in this moment coming from totally different areas of the spectrum. And yet Jesus responded to them both in the same way because of faith. This is where you start to get passages like Galatians 3:28. You know, at the foot of the cross, there's neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male nor female. All the barriers are washed away. Why? Because the barriers don't matter. What matters is Jesus. Who he is and his power of what he has to do. Okay, let's keep going. A large crowd followed. A woman was there who was subject to bleeding for 12 years, completely ostracized. She had suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors and had spent all she had. Yet instead of getting better, she grew worse. When she heard about Jesus, she came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak because she thought, if I just touch his clothes, I will be healed. Jesus would have had a prayer shawl like all good rabbis did that would have been draped around his head, would have probably gone down to the bottom, had little tassels at the end that a lot of times that they would run through their fingers as they're praying. As some of the Jewish tradition goes, they would actually believe that there was almost like magical dust that would be at the edges of the prayer shawls of the rabbis. And so she's basically taking that custom, that understanding, just trying to touch the hem of his robe, one of those tassels, because she believed that he was so powerful that even just touching the hem of his robe could heal her. Immediately, euthus, verse 29, her bleeding stopped, and she felt in her body that she was freed from her suffering. At once Jesus realized that power had gone out from him. What that means, I have no idea. I mean, seriously, what does that even mean? Oh, I just felt some power leave. Like, I don't know. Let's just let it be what it is. A mystery. He turned around in the crowd and asked, "Who touched my clothes?" An absurd question. You got it. And Big Mouth Peter in just a minute. He's the one that has to say verse 31. You see the people crowding you, don't you, Jesus? And how can you ask, who touched me? How about everyone? I'm touching you now. Is that what you felt? But Jesus kept looking around. He says, Peter, you still don't get it. But Jesus looked around to see who had done it. Then the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell at his feet. Same posture as what we saw Jairus, the synagogue ruler, in. Fell at his feet. And trembling with fear, told him the truth, the whole truth. He said to her, "Daughter," notice the language there. What is significant about that? What? Say it again. Yeah, we have a connection with the Jairus' daughter, but what else? Think about this woman who has been ritually unclean for 12 years. Whether you're talking her religious family or her actual family, she's probably not felt like she was a part of anything significant communally in quite a long time. And Jesus looks at her, and the first word he says is a familial term, daughter. He gives her dignity. In that moment, she must have been overwhelmed. Because all of her suffering, although physically it was painful, sociologically sometimes that can be more painful than even the physical pain you're experiencing. This is something that should really tell us about how to interact with the poor and things of that nature. Matter of fact, one of my friends, I don't know if I've told the story in here or not, but it fits here, so we'll tell it again. One of my friends, his testimony is pretty littered with a lot of gang activity. He's now a preacher in Pekin, Illinois, dedicated to Jesus. And if you saw him, you never would have guessed that his background has to do with, you know, bashing people's heads into curbs and pistol whipping people, if not shooting at people. And that's, you know, he spent time in gang prison. That's the way his brothers were too. And one of his older brothers was in gang prison, and for some reasons, you know, through gang turf wars inside the gang prison, he was thrown into the hole for 21 days. For like a month. And his brother talked about how, you know, there would be an hour a day when he was allowed out of his cell, and it was just a shower, and he basically would be kind of just held at gunpoint, and then he'd go to the shower, take the shower, and then he'd come back and they'd feed him by, you know, passing it underneath the door. 21 days. And he said when he came out, whenever he was finally released from the hole, he said he remembers that whenever the guard was cuffing him to take him back down to the rest of the community, that the guard touched his arm. And he said he immediately began to weep. I mean, this big, tough guy just beginning to weep. And he told his brother, he said, "I had just forgotten what it felt like for people to touch you." I don't care how hardened you are. Everyone needs community. And sometimes the deepest wounds that are in someone's life comes from them feeling like they don't belong anywhere. Even if they act like that's the noble thing that they're doing, is separating themselves out intellectually and individually because I'm going to pioneer my own way. It eventually does something to you psychologically, and even physically, and emotionally, and definitely spiritually. And when Jesus looks at this woman and says, daughter, man, that's the word she's been looking for 12 years. Daughter, what does he say? Your faith has healed you. Because of you understanding who I am and what I'm here for, that's healed you. So go in peace. So ironic. In light of the Pax Romana, that Jesus now is the one that is issuing out the peace that only God can give. It's not a peace that comes through a sword, but it's a peace that actually sets people free. Go in peace and be freed from your suffering. Verse 35, while Jesus was still speaking, some men came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue ruler. Your daughter is dead, they said. Why bother the teacher anymore? The teacher anymore. Because what we need now is not a healer, what we need now is a funeral director. And that's not his modus operandi. Ignoring what they said, Jesus told the synagogue ruler, don't be afraid, just believe. What does he tell the synagogue ruler? Act like the woman. That's what he tells him. She comes to him fear and trembling. And Jesus says, because of your belief, because of your pistis is the same word used in Greek for believe and your faith that he says to the woman. Act like the woman. Act like the ostracized woman that you wouldn't even have let in your synagogue. Act like her and everything will be fine. He did not let anyone follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. The inner three emerges for the first time. They will appear together three more times in the Gospel of Mark. Transfiguration, the questioning about the destruction of the temple, and the Garden of Gethsemane. The inner three has four appearances together. And the questioning of the temple includes Andrew as well. But the inner three is primarily the focus there. Do I have time to do a caveat? I'll just say it in one sentence. I think the reason why these are the inner three is not because these are the ones with the most potential, but because these are the ones that needed the most help. That's you can say that I'm wrong, but these three consistently throughout the Gospels are the ones that say the most stupid and foolish things. Peter, hello. James and John, hey, the Samaritans, if you want to, we'll call down fire and wipe them all out, Jesus. Hey, Jesus, will you grant us anything that we ask? When you go into the kingdom, can we have the right and the seats on the right and your left? That's the inner three, ladies and gentlemen. Awesome. And yet these become the rulers of the kingdom that we're fruits of. Verse 38, when they came to the home of the synagogue ruler, Jesus saw a commotion with people crying and wailing loudly. Why? Because at a funeral, it's an honor game. And the louder the commotion, the louder the more people that are there wailing and bemoaning what's happening, the more honorable of a person that you were. The living. It's a way of giving honor not just to the dead, but to the living. It's one of the reasons why Herod the Great said he knew that no one was going to be upset whenever he died because he was so vicious. So instead what he did is he had a plan that he took all the religious leaders of the land, and at the moment of his death, they were all to be killed so that there would actually be mourning in the land. Thankfully, it didn't happen. They actually, whenever he died, everybody was like, forget that. He's dead. What's he going to do? Punish us for not killing them? So there was a great jubilation. Great irony. Verse 39, he went in and said to them, why all this commotion and wailing? The child is not dead, but asleep. But they laughed at him. Oh, Jesus. You can heal people, but you can't check a pulse. Good. After he put them all out, and that word language there is ekbalo. And we'll see that word come up throughout the Gospel of Mark, usually in a judgment context. Now, I'm not saying he's condemning them here. But what I'm saying is the judgment language that precedes the resurrection language probably isn't an accident. After he ekbaloed them, he took the child's father and mother and the disciples who were with him and went in where the child was. He took her by the hand and said to her, Talitha kum, which means, little girl, I say to you, get up. Why does he need to translate that Aramaic phrase? he's writing to Romans that more than likely Aramaic wouldn't have been their native language. Immediately, Euthus, the girl stood up and walked around. She was 12 years old. Do you see the connection, Israel? Do you see the connection? At this, they were completely astonished. Naturally, he's not just healing people, he's resurrecting them. He gave strict orders not to tell anyone. Did I say that right? He gave strict orders not to let anyone know about this, and told them to give her something to eat. Notice how this completely contrasts what just happened in the Decapolis. He goes back into Jewish territory, and once again he says, don't tell anybody. And what do you think probably happened? We don't know what happened. But what do you think probably happened? More than likely, they disobeyed. It's kind of hard to keep that secret. Whenever people just moments ago laughed at Jesus because they knew she was dead, hence the reason why they were wailing and mourning. But you also see a contrasting here that whenever Jesus comes on the scene, actions of mourning simply don't make sense. We've had this discussion already with the accusation of fasting. Why don't your disciples fast? And what does Jesus say? It makes no sense for them to be in a posture of mourning whenever the bridegroom is here and it's time to celebrate. They're all mourning again. He walks in the situation and he says, don't mourn, I'm here. They start laughing. He says, actually, that's a little closer to the emotion I want you to get to, but not for the reason why you're there. He says, the bridegroom has come. Don't be mourning. I give life. And the 12 and the 12 come together and you start to see what he's ultimately doing. These scenes, more than pointing to his miracle abilities, is pointing to the agenda of the kingdom. The kingdom's come to give life, even to the people that are in absolute desolation, even to a nation that's in such disarray that they treat the ostracized, not as people to be ministered to, but as people to be kicked out. And Jesus says, and through me, all of this will be healed. Down to the ostracized woman, up to the synagogue rulers. I love you guys. The next 2 days you're going to have a special guest. I'll let the mystery just continue till then. Is it Jesus? I hope so.